Hello, in terms of taking seats, have you revealed who you need to start on time? It's my pleasure today to introduce the Insights speaker, Colin Driscoll. My name is Jeff Humphries. Colin is a superannuation consultant. He's a trustee director. He's on the SCT. He's part of the Disclosures and Projections Subcommittee of the Institute. And he has written today a very useful paper for our discussion. I've known Colin for around 30 years, and it's he's a real blessing, if you like, for the Institute through his insights and the amount of work he does and the very useful work that he does for us. In this session, Colin's discussing his latest paper, Analysing Australian Investment Performance, and extending that into the assumptions that may be appropriate to derive from that. The paper updates three previous papers presented in May 05, September 07, and September 09. The session will be run as Colin's going to talk about the investment performance for about half an hour. Then there's a period for questions, and then he's going to deal with the assumptions. And then there's time for some more period for questions.
Thank you, Jeff. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm curious. I'd just like to start off with a question, if I could. I'm curious to know how many people here today were here 4 years ago when I made a similar presentation. Pretty quick hands up. You were here 4 years ago? Didn't do quite as good as well. I've got a few more hands involved. Anyway, I hope those that are coming along for a second time get some value add out of four-year update. I certainly, personally, have got some value out of doing the extra work. As Jeff mentioned, this is, in fact, it's about the seventh time I've done a review of assumptions. And each time I've used the same broad methodology that I'll explain a little bit later. But each time, further experience, further input from other people, and the unfolding experience have led to changes in the methodology, and this time is no exception. I've made two significant changes, one in relation to the way I fit sine curves to determine economic cycles, and the second in relation to running averages. Some of the weaknesses of running averages means that I've had to adapt the method a little bit. I'll touch on that a little bit later. The slide that's up in front of you at the moment attempts at just giving an overview of the 54 years that the paper deals with. There used to be a time when if you took four-year averages, which is what I thought they are, the four-year running averages, if you took four-year running averages of balanced portfolio performance, you could wipe out the negatives. That doesn't sort of hold anymore. We actually went under for quite a period just recently. There may not be very many in the room who can remember when salary increase, which is the red line, or AWE actually, reached a peak in the 1970s where the four-year averages reached 17.4%. The other feature that I just want to draw to your attention is the purple line, which is balanced portfolio performance. Notice the swings on the right-hand side. They sound warning bells for how crucial it is to get the right period when analysing investment performance. Because if you go in and out of those swings, you're going to get extremely different results. The presentation today will, for necessity, be just an overview. I'll talk about why the paper was written, what's in the paper, and some of the results. As you can see, just a small fraction of the many tables and charts that are in the paper. It's also important that I cover some acknowledgements because the paper is largely a tea method. First, why was the paper written? It was written because I perceived a demand versus supply gap in Australia in this area. For many sectors, often for commercial reasons, and particularly in relation to data for long-term assumptions. And the other thing that surprises me is there's very little documented assumption methodology. It just seems to be assumed that actuaries know how to analyse the data and produce assumptions. There's very little that I can find in terms of textbooks or documentation of how to go about it. There's an obvious demand pull, and I won't spend long on this slide because it'd be familiar to actuaries. We use investment assumption in most of our work in all practice areas. And as well as using it all the time, another issue that I felt needed to be covered was what's the impact of the global financial crisis. Section 9 of the paper expands on that, and I'll touch on it later on. On the supply side, I guess I'm doing a bit of pushing, I'll be quite open about it. I'm fortunate to have what I believe is a very valuable 54-year database of investment performance. It's a mixture of National Mutual, AXA, EFG investment unit price data, which goes back to 48 years ago when the EFG system commenced. And it's mixed in with that, there's published indices and published rates over 4 to 54 year periods. I'm personally very keen to see Australian actuaries make greater use of stochastic models. I think we're starting to catch up, but there was a time when we were way behind the rest of the world. Also, I think there's a very definite place for historical simulations. Stochastic simulations are fantastic, but they can be a bit of a black box. But you can get a lot of value out of historical simulations. And I'll expand on that a little bit later. Autocorrelations and economic cycles are two other topics that I'd like to see the actuarial profession do more work on. The paper falls into two parts, as Jeff mentioned, and I'll stop for questions at the end of examination of the investment performance. The broad structure of the paper is to analyse the results, analyse the trends within the results, and from that to develop assumptions, which will be the second half of the talk. The assumptions are intended to be realistic. They clearly are for stochastic models, but that can also be used for deterministic models by just turning off the stochastic element. They're intended to be for medium and long-term work, and I define medium term as 3 to 10 years, and long term as being 10 to 40 years. Now that's my definition. I'm very conscious of the fact that if you ask an investment manager, his horizon will be about half of that, both in relation to what's medium and what's long. He or her, sorry, lead sectors. There are 15 sectors dealt with in the paper. They cover gross security, interest income, and on the bottom left-hand side, what I call financial indicators. The financial indicators serve the obvious purpose of helping with the valuation of liabilities in a consistent manner, consistent with your investment performance in the other two areas. If you look closely at the slide, you'll notice that there's a mixture of red and black text. And to take Australian shares as an example, most of it's red, which is an indicator of National Mutual AXA data. And the last 4 years, which is the last four characters, is black. It's published indices. And I'll expand on that point. There's a little bit of brown if you look closely. Direct property has got some, I used to use 2/3 AMP data plus 1/3 National Mutual data for direct property. So that's where AMP came into the story. Section 3 of the paper defines the database, gives full details. And importantly, a lot of the data was not available for the full 54 years. But for a number of reasons, it was critical that I backdated to a common date, and I chose 30th of June 1959, 54 years ago. One of the reasons for that is cross-correlations. It's extremely valuable to have a complete database for doing cross-correlation work, but it's also been valuable for a myriad of other reasons. I used two different backdating techniques. The first one, which is on this slide, is just to use a different data series. In a sense, that's not backdating, it's just picking up what's available. You'll notice in a few spots there's actually three dots and then a date, which indicates there's actually been two changes. To give you an example, for Awati that I use is Awati for persons. That didn't exist prior 1981, so I used Awati for males. And prior 1974, Awati didn't exist, and I've used AWE for males. So that sort of thing's happened in the other sectors. The important issue here is the grey bit at the top. For seven of the sectors, I've changed in 2009, which is 4 years ago. And basically I've changed from National Mutual AXA data to published indices. When I did that, I had to make a decision. Would I just polis polis move across, or would I backdate and collect past published indices? I decided not to do that for three reasons. First of all, it's a heck of a lot of work. It's extremely hard for a sole practitioner like myself to get quarterly future data, let alone to try and get quarterly past data. Another reason is that even if I had managed to get the past historical data for the published indices, it would have varied sector to sector, so I would have ended up with a dog's breakfast. Some would go a long way back, and some would go a short period back. And the third reason was a deliberate strategy that I understood the database up to 2009. I published work based on that database. I wanted to prepare a paper, as I have done in 2013, and I wanted the difference between the two to reflect the last 4 years' investment performance. I didn't want it to be distorted by old backdating. So it was a deliberate strategy to change across. But clearly there's scope for a problem there, and perhaps some researcher might like to pick up my database and explore the differences between it and published indices. I'm very happy to help if someone wants to have a go at that. The other method of backdating that I used was the applied method of least squares. I didn't just do it blindly. In each case, I've done it by picking up known sectors that have got certain features that are relevant to the sector that I'm backdating. To illustrate that, I'll take the H sector at the top there. H is my code for Hedge International Shares. Hedge International Share performance is obviously a function of It's obviously a function of I, which is unhedged international share performance. It's also a function of the exchange rate, which is the next term, and that's the Aussie dollar against the US dollar. And of course, there's a balancing item to make it fit. So that sort of technique is used on all the other sectors. You'll notice in two spots, there's a little D. Little D is for delta for the delta bond rate, or the delta bond force, actually. Clearly, the performance of fixed interest sectors is dependent on movements in the bond rate as well as the absolute level of the bond rate. What are the statistics covered in the paper? They fall into two groups. The first group is the obvious things like risk margins, coefficient of variation, skewness, kurtosis, correlations, which are the output and the assumptions that I need for the stochastic model. The bottom right-hand group is first of all a group that are in section 8 of the paper that exists just for historical purposes, just to record the historical results. You notice that they use a 44-year average. I'll explain that in a moment. Also, note that skewness, kurtosis, and all the correlations are based on forces, whereas risk margins and the coefficient of variation are based on rates. There's a paragraph 211 in the paper that I'll leave you to read at some stage. It's my attempt at explaining why stochastic models are usually based on rates as inputs, forces as the calculation mechanism, and then rates as output. Just have a read of 211. The other feature is that the risk margins are the risk margin over the 10-year bond rate. They're actually, it's explained in the papers, I take the 10-year bond rate, I normally lag it by 6 months, so that it better correlates with 12-month returns, such as cash rates, for example. You place correlation between cash rates and the bill rate, if you put the bill rate in the middle of the year. But for the purpose of determining the risk margins, I've actually lagged the bond rate by a further 9 months, so a total of 15 months lag. And section 6 of the paper explains why I chose 15 months. It's just really a technique to stabilise the risk margins, because you get a better correlation between fixed interest returns and the bond rate 15 months ago than you do against the immediate bond rate. If you think about that, it's pretty obvious. However, it's just a technique. It's a technique for stabilising the risk margins and making them easier to analyse. It has no consequence for the stochastic model and how it's used in the model. And also note that everything up to section 16 of the paper is before tax and before fees. At the very end of the paper, I then introduce tax and then fees in the final sections. So the bulk of what you'll see here this afternoon will be before tax and fees. First, let's just have a very quick look at the historical results. It'll be very quick, and I'll just touch on the peaks in the various histograms. First of all, each histogram is the average of four results. I've got quarterly data. I've got quarterly data points, but yearly statistics. So I've actually averaged, each histogram is the average of four quarter ends. And to get everything onto this chart, I've actually shown every second year, so there's a missing year in between each histogram. Except for the final, where I showed both the final year and the previous year, and then that's 3 years ago, that's 5 years ago, etc. You see Australian shares reached a height of 13%. International shares unhedged, much lower and declining due to currency effects, of course. Direct property, fairly stable. Balanced portfolio reaching a height of 10.6. 10-year bond rate reaching a height of 8.9. Capital stable, 9.5 is in the peak. Notice that Australian fixed interest actually underperformed cash. Now that would come as a surprise to most investment managers, and I believe that it's because they would typically be looking at the last 20 years of investment performance. During the last 20 years, the bond rate has tended to be coming downwards, and therefore the fixed interest performance has looked pretty good. But by using 44-year averages deliberately, they take out that effect by construction, and therefore you get a very different picture, which shows one of the advantages of assessing what I call the economic cycle. AWACI reaches a maximum of 7.7 and is slowly declining. CPI reaches a maximum of 5.7 and is slightly increasing. So if you take the difference between those, the productivity element is about 2% and gradually falling. Now I'd like to turn to section 9 of the paper and touch on the global financial crisis. The first chart shows, for a balanced portfolio, the unit price at quarterly intervals. The unit price starts at 8 and rises to a maximum 50, approximately 50 years later, of 975 at 3907. Bear in mind this is quarterly data, so I haven't quite got the peak. The actual peak in the balanced portfolio price was, I think, a couple of months after the 30th of September. In the following 18 months, the balanced portfolio unit price fell 34.3% to a low at 31st of March 2009. And then in the last 4 years and 3 months, it climbed back up 54.6% from that low level to reach an historical maximum of 989 at 30th of June 2013. The second chart, which is the same as the first but on a log scale, clearly gives you a much better view of what's going on. And you start to see that the global financial crisis is a sort of repeat of the 1970s. And that's a feature which I'll now explore in a bit more detail. Over the 54 years, the balanced portfolio earned 9.33% compound interest. So what I did was I discounted the unit prices by 9.33% per annum. So this is a chart of the discounted unit price. And by discounting it in that way, it starts at 8 and finishes at 8 by design, because I've discounted all the investment performance out of it. You can think of it conceptually as a series of present values. If you're standing back in 1959, these are the present values that emerged in the future. I did this to identify the peaks, and I identified through this means the four different peaks in investment performance, followed by four drops. I then set the unit price, not the discounted unit price, I set the unit price to 100 at each of those four peaks and tracked what happened in the subsequent 6 years. The 1987 peaks and the 2000 peaks were very shallow when examined in this manner. You can hardly even detect them. The two that matter are the red and the dark blue, which are the red being the global financial crisis and its recovery, and the blue being what happened after 30th of December 1972. Notice that they track each other fairly closely for the first 3 years. And it shows up down here where they're compared against the 1972 peak. But in the last 3 years, the post-global financial crisis has not kept up with the recovery in 1973, 74, 75. We've gradually fallen behind. Going back to the discounted unit price, I put a polynomial through to get a trend. As explained in section 9 of the paper, I used the average of a fourth and fifth degree polynomials. If you look closely at the chart, you can see the faint lines there, the 4 and 5 degree polynomials. The end result reached a peak here, and it actually has exactly, that is, the starting point turns out to be exactly the peak. And the period, that's what I was trying to establish, the period from peak to peak is 40.75 years. That is my first stab at what is the economic cycle. I'll come back to that in a moment. Section 5 of the paper deals with economic cycles and establishes the basis by which I've attempted to measure them. Using bonds as an example, this is a graph of bond forces. Bond forces at quarterly intervals. The starts in March 1958 and works through to June 2013. There's also a projection through to 2045. That is not the purpose of doing it. I did it purely just to sort of get an indicative feel of where these trends were heading. The purpose of doing this work is to establish the past economic cycle, not making any predictions for the future at all. My purpose is to establish the past economic cycle. And there's also other objectives. It's a very good way of understanding the data to do this sort of work. The results shown, and this one, for example, is an optimum result. It's the best fit that you can get using the sum of two sine curves. The two sine curves to get this fit are one with a period of 24.75 years and one with a period of 53.75 years. And they add together to give that strange shape. They give a very high 91.2% fit. So using the sum of the squares of the residuals, the curve explains 91.2% of the actual results. Note also that the orange is the result that I got 4 years ago in 2009. So the orange only picks up the data for 2009. The purple is my current work. Notice that the trend is getting longer, or expressed another way, the economic cycle is distinctly getting longer. And that happens with all the sectors. The next one is CPI. You can see it doesn't fit the data as well. The fit is 57.6%. The data here, by the way, starts in September 49. That's when quarterly CPI data first became available. But again, you see that the purple line is longer than the orange line. Perhaps I should also mention that the curve fitting is not just curve fitting the data. I've actually discounted the data first. I've discounted the data by 0.5% per quarter, or 2% a year. A 2% a year doesn't sound very much. You can think of it as a productivity discount, if you like. But when you do it 2% a year back over 54, you're discounting a lot of the data. And, for example, prior to 1967, I'm in effect only counting less than 40% of the data. So it's a gradual discount built into the curve fitting. But I've also, in the Section 5, for those that are interested, I've also showed zero discount. So you get an idea of the sensitivity. In some circumstances, it's quite sensitive to the discount. In others, it's not. A WOTI, the fit here is not as good again. It's 49.8%. But notice that the cycles have gotten even longer. Now, you might have noticed that all three of these curves that I've been showing have got some very odd shapes. The AWOTI one, for instance, you're starting to see that if you look at the orange line, it had this flat shape through there. The purple line is starting to develop a new cycle. 23-year type cycle is starting to develop in the middle. But it becomes impossible to work. I previously had examined the cycle length by looking at the minimums, and you just can't establish a minimum from that. The shapes are so weird, and have become even more weird, that technique didn't work. But what I decided to do was, for the purpose of examining the economic cycle, I deliberately chose a single sine curve that did a best fit on the single sine. Of course, then by definition, I get rid of the strange shapes and I've got a symmetrical shape. I've still got a pretty good fit for bonds. The fit for bonds is 82.3%. The fit for CPI is 44%. And the fit for AYT is 34.1%. There's two things to take away from here. The first is that CPI and AYT both reached a minimum in 2001, whereas bonds reached a minimum 8 years later, in 2009. What this tells us is that CPI and AYT have led interest rates by 8 years. That intriguing 8-year lag is explored in section 14 of the paper and developed further for those that might be interested. Notice also at the bottom that the period of the bond curve is 49 years, the period of the CPI curve is 40.25, and the period of AYT is 42.75. I then took a weighted average of those three results, plus the 40.75 that I mentioned before for a balanced portfolio. I weighted them according to their goodness of fit, and I got my 44 years that I've used for the bulk of the analysis. For some purposes, I also used 40 years, which is about the inflation economic cycle. I first did this sort of work about 7 years ago, and a senior member of the profession encouraged me to have a look at Australian shares. I'm not sure it throws much light because there's so much noise in Australian shares. But it does show some fascinating 3.4-year cycles, nine-year cycles, and you get this sort of effect. It shows up, but you notice that the fit is only 21.6%. The blue area in the middle is then blown up on the next chart. When you look deeper into it, you can see that the curve fitting has done a reasonable job picking up the share performance of recent times. And in fact, by pure fluke, it's done a marvellous job at 30th of June this year. It's absolutely spot on, and in fact, I think you'll find that since 30th of June, the month of August, has followed exactly that, and hold your breath as to what's going to happen afterwards. I'd now like to break and give you the opportunity to ask any questions. I've indicated on the slide some possible areas that you might like to question me about, but basically it's anything to do with the investment performance or the database.
Well, that's an impressive and extensive database, but in terms of demand, what's missing are some of the alternative asset classes, the non-traditional things like infrastructure, hedge funds.
Yeah.
What consideration have you given to those rather problematic areas?
I think the answer is close to zero. I thought 15 was pretty challenging, or 11 investment sectors plus 4 financial indicators. That gives a pretty good scope. What I am conscious of is I recently added hedged international shares. That's the H sector. It was a recent addition. I took out mortgages to fit back into the 15. But I'm conscious that by analysing correlations, etc., against other sectors, you can still learn a lot from what you've got compared to any new additions. But as a sole practitioner, it's very hard for me to get access to that sort of data. Any other questions in those areas? Global financial crisis or curve fitting? If not, I'll move on to the second half.
It's called Go back to slide 5.4. Figure 5.4, sorry.
Can you give me a clue? What was it again?
Figure 5.4.
Figure 5.4.
Yeah. You said it was CPA. Next one. It's 5.4.
Oh, sorry. 5.4, that one. Yep.
Yeah. You were saying on CPI fitted and...
Yep.
The other one was a wide fitted lag the bonds fitted.
Yep.
It shows that on the right side, but
yep.
On the left side, it's actually up. It's coming after the bonds fitted.
Correct. Yes, correct. That's how it's not a static situation. That was just sort of a byproduct of this chart. Except the issue that you're dealing with is explored more in Section 14, I think, is the paper which deals with lags. It happened to be a byproduct of this, so I brought it up at that point. About 8 years has been fairly stable through most of this period, which you're quite right, it didn't hold back there. It's also by lagging the data I've found that the correlations are much more stable. The non-lag correlations tend to fluctuate a lot more than the lag correlations. Okay, I think I should move on to assumptions. Sorry, one more?
With a lot of analysis of investment performance, we're roughly looking at 5, 7, 10 years. Because you seem to focus on 4 years. What's the rationale for that 4 years?
The 4 years was nothing more than giving that picture right back at the very start. I just wanted to get rid of a bit of the noise, but show you a broad picture of shapes of that over the period. The period that's far more relevant to what I'm discussing is 44 years. 44 years is what I've assessed as the economic cycle, or somewhere between 40 and 49. That's the important output, not the 4 years, that was just an arbitrary number to give you a bit of a feel for the shape of the performance. Okay, I'd like to move on to assumptions. First, just an overview of the way I did it. I will explore it through a quick case study in a moment. There are 6 steps to the methodology. Step 1 is to break the database up into 4 parts, ending at the end of each calendar quarter. So I create effectively 4 annual databases. Step 2 is what I've covered to this point. The next thing you have to do is determine your economic cycle. I've done that and I've determined 44 years. I've also used 40 years as an alternative set of numbers for risk margins and coefficients of variation, just to give me two looks at the data. But I've also used 40 years for the order of correlation work. Step 3 is to determine your annual statistics that you're examining, be they means or standard deviations or whatever. Then to take 10-year running averages of the 4-year, of the 4-point average. So you average your 4 quarters to produce step 4, and then take running averages. Then I'll put a quadratic trend through the running averages, and I project it out 6 years. I've actually only used 4 of the 6 years in the actual numerical results. But I did it for 6 years just to check that the projections were not running into things like correlations greater than 1 or less than minus 1 or coefficients of variations which are negative and that sort of problem. So for all practical purposes, it was a 4-year projection, not a 6. And lastly, I focused on the second year of the projection for most of the results, but I introduced some professional judgment in a few spots, which I'll now elaborate on. I'll take as an example the property trust sector, which I call sector Q. It's one sector, and I'm going to examine just one statistic. The particular statistic I'm going to examine is skewness. So steps 1 and 3 are illustrated on this slide. Step 1 is to look at the September data, and the data we're looking at here is forces. These are annual forces for the September quarter. Step two is to calculate the 40-year period, which we've done. So I then take the 44-year statistics for the mean, standard deviation, the skewness and the kurtosis. We can extract down the 44-period standard for those statistics. That completes step three. Step four is then to introduce the other three quarter ends and to get four lots of statistics. And notice how different the skewness is across those four calendar quarters. You need a heck of a lot of data to determine skewness and similarly kurtosis. So I've taken the arithmetic average of those four results and I've determined that the skewness at the end of step four is -237%. Now that's not my assumption, that's purely history. It's the latest skewness. Step four then takes running averages and repeats what I've just done 10 times going backwards. And often it's useful to plot the results. This is one particular example where it was very useful to plot it because it showed that that's the global financial crisis and its impact on the property trusts. But it's interesting what's happened since is there's been remarkable stability in the skewness. So again, you come to the 237% negative, which I mentioned before. That's the latest skewness result. Step five is to put a quadratic trend through those results. And it's actually a weighted quadratic trend. The weights are explained. For 44 years, I think the weight at the start is 50%, and the weight at the end is 100%. The orange line is the one 4 years ago. You can see that the current results are quite different, and this is often the case. It's particularly the case this time because previously I used a 39-year economic cycle. I've now moved it out to 44 years. And I think with the wisdom of hindsight that the 39 years should probably have been something like 41 years. So we're examining the difference between 44 and 39. It shows up quite markedly on the charts. I then go out, project, that's time zero, which is now, or the last 12 months. I project out 2 years, which takes you to 301, -301. In normal circumstances, that would be my assumption for the future. However, professional judgment then comes into play. In section 10 of the paper, I explain why I regard the property trust performance as an outlier. It's a very clear outlier in the 54 years of data. And because it's an outlier, I felt it was not appropriate to continue projecting the global financial crisis. So rather than use 301, I chose to use -237 as my skewness. In other words, I didn't predict the continuance of the global financial crisis. Now this technique is then repeated many times over. First of all, it's repeated for risk margins, but because of the importance of risk margins, I'll just spend a moment on this slide. That's the risk margins for Australian shares. Notice that they've tended to be around 5%, but the trend line is indicating that the critical 2-year points that I use are 4% risk margin. And that is the assumption that I've used. The assumptions are always shown at the bottom in square brackets. I've used the 4%. For international shares, because of the impact of currency on the results, I decided, the huge impact of currency on the results, I decided to combine international shares with the property trust sector. And I've basically used the same assumptions for both. This is explained in section 6 and 7 of the paper. And I've actually used for a risk margin of 2.6% for international shares. Again, you could call that professional judgment. This is all repeated. Coefficient of variation, for those that might have forgotten, is the standard deviation divided by the mean. Just a quick refresher on skewness and kurtosis for those that haven't dealt with it for a few years. This chart shows the skewness and kurtosis effects for direct property compared to a normal assumption. The blue is a normal assumption, and the purple is my assumptions for direct property, which are minus 145% skewness and 260% kurtosis. Notice that because of the negative skewness, you get the left-hand tail, and because of the high kurtosis, you get the high central values for direct property. Notice also that for the blue, normal distribution, the skewness is zero, but the kurtosis is not zero. The kurtosis is minus 19%. And the reason is that I'm using discrete data. It's 40 data points, 40 years results, and with discrete data points, the kurtosis is not zero. That's one of the challenges you have when you try and model skewness and kurtosis. The textbooks tend to think in continuous terms where the kurtosis is zero. But when you're modelling, you're actually modelling discrete periods. So it's a bit harder. Okay, this is all repeated hundreds of times for each of the different statistics in the 15 sectors. Just mentioned here that the skewness for Australian shares used to be close to zero, and so did this. This was also very close to zero. I've got previous results, and it was fair to assume a skewness of zero for shares in years gone by. But it's no longer. It's very clearly nowadays negative. I'm using minus 28% for shares, Australian shares, and minus 46% for international shares. Kurtosis, exactly the same technique, so I won't harbour it. But I'd now like to look at cross correlations. With cross correlations, I've varied the methodology a little bit. I found that you got much better results if, instead of doing the projection at the end, at step 5 and step 6, I got better results if I projected first and then did change the order of the steps. So what I did was I took the 54-year database, I projected it out 6 years by using the projected risk margins that I'd already established. So I changed the 54-year database to a 60-year database, and I then determined two lots of cross-correlations. One is the correlation of the ranks of the data, which I call rank cross-correlations. There's a second set of results in the paper which are standard cross-correlations. I'd like to pay a tribute to the assistance that I've had from Alan Brown at this point. Alan Brown put me onto the idea of using rank data. It's a fantastic way of dealing with cross-correlations. It's well recorded in the literature that correlations, in particularly cross-correlations, are highly affected by skewness, non-zero skewness, and by outliers. It absolutely throws them all over the place. But if you use the rank of the data and then determine the correlations of the ranks, you're then dealing with uniformly distributed data, and you remove that effect completely. It's a terribly valuable technique that I've built into my assumption setting and also into my stochastic model. So these are rank cross correlations for shares compared with AWATI and shares compared with AWATI lag by 8 years, which is the 8 years I referred to before. Notice that the impact is to turn a negative into a positive. The share sector and a lot of the, and I think the same with international shares, is negatively correlated against salary increases. Now that might come as a surprise to some actuaries who have lived with an environment where they believed that investment performance was positively correlated with salary increases. Well, it's not. It's negatively correlated. If you use 12 months correlations, if you increase the interval beyond 12 months, you may start to get some positive correlations. But on an annual basis, the correlation of shares versus salary increases is negative. If you lag it, it becomes positive. This is an abridged set of cross correlations. The full lot would be too big to fit on the slide. Notice that the two financial indicators that are shown here, notice the negatives here. So Australian shares, listed property and fixed interest are all negatively correlated against CPI and AWATI. Cash and direct property do much better. They're very strongly positively correlated against CPI and AWATI. Now I'd like to move on to order correlations, which you'll quickly gather is a bit of a hobby of mine. First, just to get started, compare the order correlations of Australian shares against the order correlations of the balanced portfolio. They are quite similar, and that's fairly obvious if you think about it, because the Australian share component of the typical balanced portfolio is the dominating feature of the shape of the performance. There's some slight differences. Notice that the balanced portfolio is positive in this territory. I believe that's because of the impact of property trusts. There's a small element of property trusts in the balanced portfolio, and that causes that little positive bit. But usually up to 5.5 years, there's a negative bias in the autocorrelations. A negative autocorrelation has a lot of the characteristics of mean reversion. They're not the same, but they're somewhat similar. But I've always struggled with the idea of mean reversion. It gets a lot of airing in the actuarial literature, but I have great difficulty with it. The biggest difficulty I have is that I don't know what the mean is. The mean keeps changing. So what are we reverting to? We're reverting to something which is moving. I find the concept of negative order correlations much more natural. It seemed to me obvious that when the share market reaches an upper peak or a trough, there is a natural tendency for the market, I said shares a moment ago, but I could have said in any market, there's a natural tendency for the market to come back upwards. And that is what negative correlation is. All the short-term data up to the five-year point, it's got this negative bias in, which is a consequence of the market bouncing back. So I find the concept of negative order correlations much more natural than the concept of mean reversion. However, I'm aware that some people have questioned that logic because they argue that the negative order correlations may not be stable over time. And they point out that you need a lot of data to test that. Well, I'm getting to the stage now that I do have a fair bit of data. I haven't just got 54 years. I've actually got 216 years. I know they overlap. But there's still, you can learn a heck of a lot from the 216 sets of results compared to the 54 sets of results. So what I did was I broke my data into two halves. I first of all looked at the autocorrelations for the last 26 years. And separately, I looked at the autocorrelations for the first 26 years. So I've got two non-overlapping periods, 26 years apart. And I've established to my satisfaction that there is a degree of similarity between the results. I'll quickly attempt to show you how I did that. First of all, for shares, and in, I think it's Appendix A of the paper, I explain why I regard share autocorrelations and bond autocorrelations as two extremes. But shares and bonds have got totally different autocorrelation features, and they are the extremes. All other sectors lie somewhere in between them. So that's why I've examined Australian shares and the bond rate, which you'll see in a moment. What I've done is I found that if I expanded the earlier period x-axis by 60%, I got a pretty good fit of the autocorrelations. They're basically all moving together. By expanding the x-axis by 60%, what I was saying is that the autocorrelation features in the last 26 years are moving more slowly than they were 26 years ago. They're the same underlying characteristics, but they're moving more slowly. Now let's look at bonds. It was the exact opposite. With bonds, I had to contract the x-axis by 16.7%. And by contracting it, I got a very good fit, except for lags of 15 and 16, where it failed completely. But if you take those two out, again, you've got a pretty good fit. So here we reach the conclusion that autocorrelation features for the last 26 years are occurring more quickly in relation to the bond rate. The assumption that I used for autocorrelations for shares and autocorrelations for bonds were determined in the same way as I determined all the other assumptions. I took 40-year statistics, I projected them 4 years, and I focused on the second year of the projection. And that gives rise to the blue autocorrelation results there. So central minus two, as I call it, which is 2 years out in the projection, becomes my assumption. So the blue is my assumption. My assumption, therefore, inherently has got negative autocorrelations in the early years, which is important. It's got positive correlation of 17 or 18% at 6 years, 8 years. And the blue curve, if you closely look at it, sits slightly to the left of the actual results, which are in red, which are the results at time zero. In other words, in relation to shares, the autocorrelations are starting to occur a little bit more quickly, or expected to occur more quickly. Again, the opposite result for bonds. For bonds, the blue curve is to the right of the red curve, indicating that bond features are developing more slowly. Notice that the autocorrelations for bonds at a 1 year lag is 92%. In other words, 1 year bond rates are very closely related to the bond rate 12 months ago, which is pretty obvious. Appendix B of the paper puts forward some suggestions to how to model autocorrelations. Let's have a quick look at the arithmetic means according to the assumptions. The new assumptions that I've developed using the methodology I've explained are those there. They're my old assumptions of 4 years ago. And that's the differences. You can see that the outworkings of my work is to lower the growth sectors by 0.4 or 0.5%. A bit of a mixed bag with the fixed interest sectors. Australian fixed interest I've dropped back by 0.1. Some small increases in the other sectors except international fixed interest, which I left unchanged. The balance portfolio I've effectively lowered the mean by 0.33, for capital stable by 0.14. There's two other important changes. I've increased my allowance from a whiting from 3.75 to 4.2, and I've increased allowance for inflation from 2.5 to 2.7. Section 6 and 7 of the paper explain how all those results were obtained. This is a complete table of the investment assumptions, apart from the correlations, which are separately tabulated. The coefficient of variations in the middle there, and the standard deviation next to it, and then the skewness and kurtosis. The colour coding here is I've first of all colour coded all the standard deviations that are greater than 4%. You can think of those, so anything that's shaded blue, you can think of as the highly volatile sectors. And anything that's shaded white, you can think of as being non-volatile in loose terms. An interesting characteristic that comes out of doing this is that anything which is volatile, greater than 4%, is associated with negative skewness and positive kurtosis. Anything which is non-volatile is associated with the opposite, positive skewness and negative kurtosis. With one exception, average weekly ordinary time earnings is a rather unique high positive kurtosis and high positive skewness. I've colour coded the skewness and kurtosis in section 12.4 of the paper into the white area, which I call minimal, which is where the skewness and kurtosis is less than 70%, or between minus 70% and zero, moderate, which is between 70% and 200%, and extreme, which is greater than 200%. And notice how many sectors on that classification are either extreme skewness and kurtosis or moderate skewness and kurtosis. So those that use log normal assumptions, beware. Think you're kidding yourself. Just quickly, for the first time this afternoon, I've introduced tax and fees. And the right-hand column is the compound average after tax, after imputation credits, after fees assumption. And the takeaway is probably balanced portfolio, 6.84%. Notice how similar it is to capital stable, the difference of 1.08% between these two. I haven't looked at the ASIC website for quite a while, but when I last looked at it, it had a differential between those two of 2%, I think. So if that's still there, I think there's a need to update it. The 6.84 for a balanced portfolio, compound net of tax and fees, fits fairly comfortably with the APRA annual statistics, which unfortunately, in relation to the results with actuarial assumptions, hasn't been updated since March 2009. I approached APRA about it and said that was the last time they've done it. But the 6.84 does compare favourably with the APRA annual statistics for actuarial assumptions, which is analysed in section 18.2 of the paper. Just quickly, some running averages for a balanced portfolio, and because I've got actuaries in the room, I've charted the real returns over a lobby. These are the real returns after tax and fees, balanced portfolio in excess of a lobby. It shows hugely fluctuating results when averaged over 12 years. For 34 years, still fluctuating results. And it's not until you get out to 44 years that you start to see some stability in the running averages. The running averages for, on a 44-year basis range between 0.9% and 1.9%, which is quite a narrow range. And it's particularly narrow at the end of the period. Now, I thought it might be informative to use the historical results to calculate 40-year super guarantee retirement benefits as a multiple of final salary. So if you picture an accumulation plan running for 40 years, accumulating results historically, and then expressing the results as a percentage of final salary. I made two assumptions. The first assumption, not shown on the slide actually, is that I assumed that the SG was in its maturity and I just examined the 12% SG. From the 12% SG, I deducted 1.5% for cost of cover and I deducted 15% for the contributions tax. So the end result was I had 8.2925 accumulating towards retirement. The other assumption I made was that the next 44 years is equal to the last 44 years. That's 44 years of balanced portfolio performance compared with 44 years of AWOTI increases. With those two assumptions, 12% SG and historical results, you get a multiple of salary ranging between just over 2 and 10 times final salary. Now, actuaries will immediately appreciate that what I'm showing here is that a fixed input produces a variable output. You've got a fixed input of 12% every year, the output has got to be variable. That's the sort of variation you get. I put a circle around this group of results here because they correspond to the period from 1973 to 1986 when salaries went up by an average over that 13-year period, went up by 12.1%. Now you could argue that that will never happen again. If you feel that that will never happen again, you take out those results. You're still looking at results varying between 5 and 10 times a multiple of salary. So it shows to me that the SG system alone will not produce satisfactory retirement benefits. Just going back to the assumptions, I've just compared what I've just said. The green line is using my assumptions for a balanced portfolio. And using my assumptions for a balanced portfolio, I get a multiple of 6.45, which fits fairly closely between, as you would expect, between the historical results. There are three appendices to the paper that deal with three entirely different topics. The first one deals with modelling of skewness and kurtosis, and it explains the use of two different methods, one a normal power approximation and the other a gamma exponential variable. For some sectors, the first produces very satisfactory results. For other sectors, the second produces better results. And for one or two sectors, it doesn't matter. The two methods tend to overlap. I think the overlapping sectors were SOREs and the government sector, not the three-year government securities, sit in the middle. Modelling autocorrelations. I mentioned a moment ago that I regard the share sector as one extreme and bonds as another extreme. And if you get the autocorrelations for those two extremes realistic, all the other sectors, by cross-correlation, tend to fall in between. If you just apply cross-correlations to those two extremes, you get reasonably satisfactory autocorrelations for all the 15 sectors. That's all explained in Appendix B. Appendix C is a summary of my OSMOD investment simulation model. It explains the 26 inputs that you need to run the model. And it also explains that the model can actually do three things. It can actually produce stochastic results, it can deterministic results, but it can also produce what I call historical random start results. The historical random start results, the way you do it is that you choose a historical period, any period that you feel comfortable with. It doesn't have to be a period ending today. It can be a past period. It can be 10 years long, or it could be 20 years long. I'm afraid it can't be longer than 54 years. You choose your data period, and you say, you satisfy yourself that that's a sort of representative period that I'm comfortable will represent, is a representation of the future. So you take that period, and you repeat it until you've got in just over 100 results. You keep the order of sequence, so you've got what's called, I think in the textbooks, called a recurrent sequence. You're just reoccurring the first set of results. You then randomly start at different times in the first period and project forward whatever period you want to project. Most of my work on projecting out 40 years. That produces results which look remarkably like stochastic results. But in fact, all they are is just repeats of history. And they have an interesting characteristic. They have means, standard deviations, skewness, kurtosis, cross-correlations, and autocorrelations in every sector, which is almost exactly the same as your chosen historical period. The only error it breaks down is when you cross over from one historical period to the next, you get a bit of a hiccup. So there's a slight blemish. But it's, for many purposes, much better than using the black box of a stochastic model. That's a quick extract out of section 20 of the paper, concluding remarks. I think I've covered, just checked through, talked about economic cycles, but perhaps I didn't make the point that it is crucial to use at least one economic cycle, or two economic cycles, or three economic cycles, but not to use fractions of the cycle. As soon as you start examining a fraction of a cycle, you're going to produce abnormal results. Talked about the sum of two sine curves techniques and care used in running averages, the impact of GFC, the dangers of using log normal models, the bias, negative bias in a balanced portfolio, the autocorrelation results, and the latter. I'd like to just conclude with some extremely important acknowledgements. The paper would not have happened without a lot of help from a lot of people. The most important, I'll run the danger of bringing up just one person, has to be Alan Brown. Alan Brown has worked with me since the start of this journey, throughout the journey, and he's still with me at the end. At the Melbourne discussion, he spoke a fair bit, and it was evident that he's got some helpful hints as to how I might improve my paper for presentation in Washington next year when I'm presenting it to the International Congress. So he's still pushing me to do a bit more work to improve some parts of Section 9 of the paper he's not comfortable with. But he's been a tremendous help for me over the years in statistical matters, in using Excel spreadsheets, and readily available for consultation. But I've had a lot of help from a lot of other people as well. To a Sydney audience, I'd like to especially thank Jeremy Waite, although she's not here today, but he wrote a paper in April 2009 called Black Swans, Fat Tails and Spherical Cows, and I've quoted from his paper in a number of sections under the heading Remember. But, I did that 4 years ago and I've decided to do it again because they're so good. I think I can repeat it after 4 years. I'll pass over that. I'd like to also acknowledge that this wouldn't have been possible without the National Mutual EFG Investment System, which was the forerunner of today's superannuation investment structures. What happens next? It's not my current intention to do another paper of this sort. I'm calling for volunteers. I'd like anyone who's at all interested in this sort of work and who would like to initially work with me, I'd be prepared to consider perhaps a co-author to a paper in 2, 3, or 4 years' time, but I have no intentions of doing it myself. I think it's time for someone else to pick up the baton. There are 3 issues that need to be addressed. There's the ongoing quarterly update of the historical data. Could be someone who's interested in pursuing that. There's the OSMOD investment the simulation model that I've mentioned, which is documented in the appendices. It requires ongoing development and modifications. I don't mean by that that there's anything wrong with it right now. I've done my level best to keep it up to date. But if these things don't stand still, you've got to keep developing if they're going to be useful. And I think there's a stack of scope in the database, but not just one paper, but many papers. If anyone would like to contact me, there's my contact details. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted to try and answer them. Yes?
Colin, John Draven, and thank you very much for that very interesting paper. Colin, about 4 or 5 slides back, am I right in thinking that your current assumption for Australian shares going forward is 10% compared to CPI of, I think, 2.7%?
That's correct, yeah.
Which would represent a 7.3% real return on shares going forward. Quite recently, there was a high-quality paper coming out from the London Business School by 3 professors called Gibson, Marsh and Staunton, something like that. And they were talking about real returns on equities of in the vicinity of 3-3.5% going forward. Is it possible that by looking at historical numbers, even historical numbers over quite a long period, we're actually looking at a period which is a historical period which may conceivably be just plain different from what we're looking at going forward?
Yeah. I'm not aware of the paper you referred to, but I'm certainly aware of the issue. I've discussed it with a number of investment managers, and my take on it is that their horizons are much shorter than mine. When they talk about the future and the likely investment results of the future, I'm generalising, but they tend to be looking at the next 10 years and forming a view of the next 10 years, or perhaps even the next 5 years. They're thinking sort of 5 years out, and as the extreme, they're thinking out 10 years. I'm not thinking 10 years, I'm modelling 40 years. I've got much longer horizon. Now, I don't know whether that's the answer in relation to the UK paper you mentioned, but I think it's a fair comment on a lot of Australian research of this type. I'm not an economist, so I can't dig deeper on that issue.
Hi, Colin. Thanks for that paper. That's fabulous. Good luck for Washington.
Thank you.
I think Section 9 is fine, but I'm like Alan Brown. So all the best. You had Table 18.1 up. I don't think you need to go back to it. It just showed net of fees and tax. And I've got your paper open here at Table 17.1, which sets out the average tax rates. And, of course, they vary for the different classes.
Yep.
Can you just explain where you got those tax rates from, and also why you used passive investment management fees rather than that?
Okay. You've touched on three issues. First of all, Alan Brown, you mentioned. The point that Alan Brown quite rightly criticises in Section 9 is that three or four of the tables I used a standard y-axis. I should have used a log normal axis. I should have used a log axis. And he's quite right. The results are distorted by the use of an arithmetic y-axis. And what I should have been using is either forces instead of rates, or I should have used a log scale. Second part of your question was, so if I just remind me?
Tax.
The tax basis that Auswide runs off is, runs off two tax rates. One is the tax rate relevant to the ongoing investment income, and the other is the tax rate relevant to capital gains and losses. The terminology I use is tax rate and deferred tax rate. The deferred tax rate in the model is applied to all of the interest, all of the investment performance, be it positive or negative, in excess of the ongoing running yield. The ongoing running yield is another assumption that's fed into the model. So each of the sectors I feed in as an assumption an ongoing running yield. So each year you determine your capital gain and loss, you apply your deferred tax rate to that. The outworkings of all of that is the numbers that are in the appendix that you commented on. The use of wholesale passive fees, that's just a standard in the model. The standard can be varied. But it was a deliberate choice because in most of the sectors now I'm using indices. So to me, the relevant fees to set against them is a passive wholesale fee. It's not appropriate to put an active fee against them because they're not active performance. Does that cover it?
Thanks.
Hi, Colin. Adrian Corbell here. I just had a question on the super guarantee. So you had a multiple salary graph up.
Yep.
Just go to that. I guess you're projecting over the same for the back multiples salary. So you're projecting over a similar time period as the working life, I suppose, for something years.
Yep.
So, and came to the conclusion that the multiple salary is inadequate under the 12%. So I was wondering what you consider to be an adequate multiple and what percentage superannuation guarantee would get you there.
Yeah. I also mentioned, because of lack of time, I didn't cover it today, but in the paper I mentioned that I've stressed the fact that these are lump sum results. And if you were to do this sort of stochastic work, which I'd love to see some researcher pick up on, and you were to model, instead of modelling lump sums, you were to model income streams, and you were to add on the age pension and look at the total income, if you looked at it in income terms, it would be more stable than these lump sum results. These are just pure lump sum results. And I don't think with lump sum results you could answer your question. Your question has to be answered by looking at income streams. But nevertheless, I still think it's valid to conclude that a fixed input will produce a variable output. That that's the point I'm driving at. And it will be very verbal. Any other questions? I was there to cover enough scope to generate questions.
Very
detailed. Well, I do hope that someone in the room or someone on the web might contact me in the future if they have an interest in any of the areas that I've touched on today.
Mark, thank you, Colin. It's a very, very detailed paper, and the methodology and depth of the research is invaluable, I think, to actually. I do hope someone takes up Colin's challenge or challenges in terms of running with the model, and we don't just let it drop there. So I think we should all thank Colin in the usual way.